the second one, or whatever, whichever one we wanted, and just find that signal.
But why do you want it narrowband?
I mean, we've seen, for example, for the binaural stars that you have a bandwidth of about 2-3 kilohertz.
Well, I think this is all the matter-based neutron star stuff. Yeah. But if the neutron stars form a black hole, then it's just it will have its modes.
But it would have a forest. So this is what people interested in, Noether theorem. Checks. They want to do this black hole spectroscopy.
Yes,
therefore, they want to see all the.
That's what I'm talking about. But maybe we can find two modes or three modes. But to produce, if you ask, if I want to excite the 10th harmonic, the 10th quasi-normal mode, what kind of initial mass, how perturbed does the black hole have to be to radiate at such a high mode? Probably in all cases, it's going to be always weighted with more energy in the low modes than high modes.
Yes.
Yeah, but so
if that's the case, it may be that we want to find signals which are not limited at 5 kilohertz, but maybe it goes to like 10 kilohertz or 15 kilohertz. And then maybe this laser interferometry is the wrong thing because we're trying to too much messing around with huge cavities. Maybe there's a different technology which is more like a room-sized technology. Like, for instance, these people who are talking about the superconducting donuts. The superconducting donuts papers. You guys know about this? Am I the only one who reads this thing?
Is this like the kilometer one or something else?
Not at all. They're not donut. Kilometer people don't use donuts.
Okay.
They're just, they have laser interferometers. But the superconducting donuts, they're like, what do you call it? Like, I don't know. They have a super strong DC magnetic field, and they're looking at the, I forgot, really. It's like processing London moments. They have a donut, which is superconducting, and it has a huge magnetic field, and their idea is that if you do some torsion on this donut, then there's a differential rotation between the donut and the electrons in the donut, and you can detect this somehow. But it's more geared toward high-frequency detection. It has a lot of this laser gyros, Sonyak speed meter stuff, where the DC component is suppressed, but at AC frequencies, it has its a lot of advantages to laser interferometry. But I would just say these schemes that people talk about, usually in the LIGO community, people say, oh, those crackpots, don't listen to them. But maybe those high frequency approaches, which it used to be people talked about it like megahertz and gigahertz, but maybe they can be adopted to work at the several kilohertz, 10 kilohertz. And then a lot of these things might become reasonable.
10 kilohertz, if you talk about laser interferometry, 10 kilohertz, you still want the detector armlets to be like kilometer size. Because, I mean, it's like you can compute the wavelengths of this for 10 kilohertz.
You would if it's free, but if the question becomes something like, could I make three detectors of 300 meters or one of 1 kilometer, I mean, what's the real trade-off? Then maybe you don't really win just by getting the length bigger, because you're not limited by the displacement noise of the mirrors.
Well, you know how the signal scale with harmonics.
It
is linear.
Yeah.
Scaling. So if you combine...
it's a linear, except if you build up the finesse of the optical cavity, then you win the same way with the signal. It's just a signal-to-noise ratio point. The signal doesn't really matter by itself.
Right.
Well, I have a different question. So, of all the orders of magnitude where you might expect a GR to break, there would be a length scale introduced.
Yeah.
Why would we expect it to take place between 15 or 914 you know, scale black holes and be a binary neutron star remnants. And it could be really tiny nano black holes or supermassive black holes.
I didn't mean like that. I just meant, for example, if you say there is a beyond GR effect for all black holes, and then it scales in some way with the mass, or the size, mass or size or whatever, then it may be advantageous for smaller ones than bigger ones. But not that it turns on all of a sudden. But then, to argue against myself, you could also say, what if the deviation from GR is a part in 10 to the 12 for any audio band signal? Then why do you think improving things by a factor of 10 or 100, you're just flailing in the dark? It'd be like that plot I showed where people had a strain of 10 to the minus 14. And they, I'm sure, in the 1970s were saying, yeah, let's just work another hour tonight. We can maybe make that first detection. And they're off by 8 orders of magnitude. We may be at the place right now. Good thing we don't know.
I mean, it seems to me that there is so much physics between, I don't know, 500 hertz and 4 kilohertz or so, that, I mean, it's sufficiently solid physics, okay? Maybe not so revolutionary as you have in mind so far. And the theoretical predictions are, you know, robust on the general features, but not detailed, so that you can say, ha, I really want to nail that particular frequency band. Also, you know, this system comes with different masses that gives you a different frequency. And so it seems to me that there is a lot of advantage in keeping a wide band. Because, I mean, I personally do not think that we should trust the, let's say, the models for what is the sort of merger signal. I think I trust the broad features with no disrespect whatsoever for people in this room. But one should just look at what nature gives you, you know, using robust techniques that do not rely on, you know, mesh filtering and so on. And there, because you do not know what is the range of masses, I think having a couple of kilohertz of bandwidth would.
But do you think if we took away the neutron star physics, do you think that your statement is still true? That in the absence, I mean,
so
let's imagine it's 10 years from now, we have completely done the exciting neutron star physics. It's now just in textbooks, you can go look it up.
Yeah.
Is there more that is enough motivation, or is that basically the whole thing?
Well, I think black holes, normal modes, they are possibly at lower frequency. That's why I said between 500 and 1 kilohertz. That is a pretty strong motivation, although you may say on a time scale of 2030, you know, LISA will do these things if you trust it. It's going to fly, you know, extremely accurately.
Yeah, that's true. So you're saying that we could do the black hole spectroscopy program.
Yeah, using the 30 or, you know, 50 solar mass black holes.
Right.
Yeah, I guess sometimes people may argue that doing this spectroscopy measurement or ring down test is different for different mass scales. Maybe it's also worse to look at low mass black holes, so it's like the curvature is larger. Yeah. So probably for some modified gravity series, the effect is larger for the small black hole.
I mean, for all this.
For the neutron stars, I mean, you have a clear case that you had the observations also in the electromagnetic, right? I think this also helps to justify building something new or doing some modifications. And I think we are still far away from understanding everything that was observed, and so I think there is some kind of perspective or some prospect of what one could possibly learn from all this stuff and how to connect it. And I think it's not something that will be done in 5 years and then we need to look for some other exciting stuff. I mean, that's more something on a timescale of maybe 10, 20 years. I mean, there's so much interesting stuff. I mean, it's not only the equation of state, it's also the whole thing about nuclear synthesis.
But I would say if we don't do anything at all, that probably the world by itself will have a factor of 5 better sensitivity for the neutron stars in the next 6 or 7 years. And by that point, it means that the rate of neutron star mergers detected will be like 100 per year. And so it means if we do nothing, we would have 1,000 binary neutron stars by 2030.
Okay, but the detection is based on the low frequency part.
Whereas I'm talking about the way that the you know, momentum is that everybody in the world will make broadband detectors slowly increasing the frequency, the sensitivity uniformly.
Yeah.
And so that means the high the kilohertz sensitivity will increase at the same rate as the 100 hertz sensitivity. And therefore, yeah, like what I was showing, we can expect it to be 5 times better than the current LIGO.
So in fact, I think there is a case to say for one of the, let's say we have 4 or 5 instruments in the world, okay? One of the instruments could be the low frequency part, forget about that, because you'll know there is going to be a merger of a binary neutron star or black hole with a timing accuracy of about 1 millisecond or so. So you know when it happens. And then if instead of just getting the, you know, factor of 5 or so in this 1, 2, 3, 4 kilohertz, you get a factor of 10, 15, 20 in sensitivity there, then you can really study the physics that happened at that point. In fact, it's very disappointing, Dennis, that you just have, you know, you guys have all this, you know, design where you really the entire bucket also goes down as well as the high frequency. I think it's, okay, who cares about the low frequency? Forget about anything below 500 hertz. Can you, just ignoring that part, can you gain even more at high frequencies? I'm provocative, of course, I think it's.
Well, it's not I mean, there's always the signal recycling detuning, which is kind of an old idea.
Okay.
And it's a price to pay because you have only one signal sideband, and so we for some time we kind of found that it's not worth the effort, but maybe it can be revisited now in this light.
So the configuration still the bandwidth at higher frequency is still quite narrow, right? So it's not like in the kilohertz bandwidth.
What's the typical bandwidth? I mean,
you can choose. Yeah.
But I think your bandwidth is always smaller than the central frequency. So if you are centered around 2 kilohertz, your bandwidth is necessarily smaller than 2 to 1. Usually, it's smaller than 1 kilohertz. So then it's always a narrow band, unless you have several of these things somehow stacked together. I don't know how to do it.
Also, I wonder about this high frequency part. Is, don't we need polarizations? Because when the neutron star merges, according to these simulations, it's like fully, there's no real symmetry. All kinds of motion is happening. And then it seems like we want to have enough detectors so we capture both polarizations of the gravitational waves for each merger, not just have here's the signal, but we want to know what's the cross and what's the plus distribution of the mass, so we can fit it to the models better.
Yeah, that's not different from binary black holes. It's basically the same for binary black holes.
Yeah, what I mean is we could not get away with just having one high frequency detector. We would want to have.
I mean, it's true that if you have only one that sees these things, you have the time frequency evolution of the signal. You know the power, you know what is the central frequencies, what is the decay time scale. It's true that you do not resolve the H plus and the H cross.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes.
All right, maybe one question that is, in my opinion, very interesting, we can look at now as well, is this one. I think probably this mostly relates to the first two questions. So we heard a lot about the simulations and the peaks in the spectrum. So how do we learn about the nuclear physics? In other words, yeah, so the fundamental mode is most prominent, but I think you don't really target the equation of state in the inner core, right? Because the fundamental mode is more like on the surface. So then, is it true that the two ways you can study the QCD in the inner core is by measuring the collapse time and by measuring P modes, or is there something else?
Also, the radial mode itself could be interesting because.
Which one?
The quasi radial mode could be interesting for probing the inner part of the remnant.
But this is not P?
The fundamental mode that has just one node. And because there the eigenfunction is more in the center, and then you could possibly learn something about the inner core. I mean, possibly you also learned something already from the quadrupolar mode, because nobody knows if the phase transition to deconfined quark matter at which density it occurs, right? If it occurs at neutron star densities, then if it's a strong first order phase transition, then you will also see it in the mass radius relation, and then you will already see it in the dominant frequency. So it all depends on the strength of this phase transition and where it occurs.
Would you see it also in the tidal deformability parameter, in the spiral?
It depends where it occurs. I mean,
okay.
you could imagine I'm currently running models where the phase transition is taking place right after merging. So before merging during the in-spiral, you still have hadronic stars, they merge, the density increases, and you go into this phase transition.
Okay.
And then the dominant frequency is somewhat different from what you actually expected based on the tidal deformability. But of course, that's a kind of fine-tuned possibility, because nobody knows at which density you have this transition.
I mean, one of the reasons why I was mentioning this 500 hertz is that because at that point, tidal deformability is,
but you wouldn't
understand correctly, starts to, have an effect. And therefore, if you have a better noise, sensitivity there, then your sensitivity to the corrections coming from tidal effects become higher, and you see them before you actually see the merger, which you're going to see also better.
So another thing might be this threshold mass that you were talking about, I guess. So if the inner core is different, I assume the threshold mass will also be different. So if you can support a much denser inner core. First order everything depends on the stellar structure. If the QCD phase transition has a strong impact on the stellar structure, it's also something that you can easily see in gravitational waves. But it's also possible that the QCD phase transition is not so strong, that it's not a first order phase transition, that it's more like a crossover maybe. And then it will be then you basically don't see anything in the mass radius relation, and then it will be also very hard to see something in gravitational waves. Then you probably really need to understand all the details of the gravitational wave spectrum, which we currently don't. It really depends on the strength of this effect, which means that, I mean, there could be something that one sees, but possibly also.
So when you do your simulation, is this the density at which the phase transition happens? Is this like your parameter, or you actually derive it from some first principles?
No, this is some
microphysical equation of state that has some phase transition implemented to quark matter. But of course, that's something that is, well, it's model dependent. I mean,
Dennis, you're asking, is there a knob you can tune?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're sure you can tune this.
And what happens when you, like, what happens qualitatively to the weight? This is your question, right?
Yeah, exactly. So my question, like, let's say you change the inner, well, let's say what nuclear physicists are interested in, like, they want to understand this physics at this critical densities. So they, let's say they calculate some few different models of phase transition, and then you put them in. And so how different your spectrum of gravitational waves is, and at what frequencies you will observe the difference?
I'm not sure if I completely understand your question. I mean, you currently we don't have so many models with phase transitions. What I can say is that in principle, qualitatively, they look very similar to the ones of purely nucleonic matter. But quantitatively, if you in particular take into account information from the in-spiral, then you might see the impact of a strong phase transition.
Yeah, that's yeah, in some sense, but what I mean, I think you presented that we can have spectrum of some peaks and then some large peak, and then this is your F peak. This F 20, right, and then F 1. So, and then let's say I would like to, let's say I'm a nuclear physicist and I would like to change the, so let's say I apply a new theory to QCD at this critical densities, and then I, my phase transition pattern changes. So how would this, like, the whole thing, would it shift or would it be larger, smaller?
Yeah, it would shift. I mean, again, you see, let's out that list. Basically, when you produce these mass rate explanations, right? So this is maybe some equation of state, and that gives you here such a spectrum. And then you can modify this equation of state, say that at some density you get this phase transition, first order phase transition, and then it maybe looks like this. And then you see that this whole spectrum shifts to higher frequencies because here you get more compact, so also the random gets more compact.
Yeah, and then my question is, so it's similar to the LIGO data analysis when you have one waveform that is determined by some 10 parameters, like speed, masses, and then from that waveform you have to sort of calculate.
So you say if you have here the equation of state, and this is your model, and you want, for instance, to tune this density adjustment. This is what you're
possibly. Yeah, I'm asking. So let's say I have a different nuclear model, indeed, and then I have some change here. But then, what if this change is due to some magnetic field, or so? How do I distinguish these effects? Where the change come from? Where does it come from?
We had this discussion about magnetic fields already. I don't think that they can really have
okay,
strong
that's good.
Quantitative impact on this, because this is really determined by the stellar structure.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, you only see a quantitative effect here on the gravitational wave spectrum if you have really here a strong, if you see already something in the mass radius relation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are models of this quark matter which really look like an ordinary hadronic equation of state. And then it will be extremely difficult to say, just from measuring one or two frequencies here, that this was a QCD phase transition.
Yeah, in fact, I could say this another way, maybe Andres. I think basically, like, a lot of these frequencies are to leading or just picking out the radius of the neutron star.
Okay.
Including the tidal probability parameter and the, you know, once you know the mass, it's basically just picking out the radius of the neutron star. So if you have some equation of state that basically, if you measure the tidal deformability parameter of these inspiraling stars at some mass,
and then compare that to like sort of the implied radius of this oscillating hypermassive neutron star, and you know, somehow it's hard to fit those two within some given equation or state without putting in some phase transition, and that might tell you that there is a phase transition. But if you just took, you know, if you just have one sort of these, you know, equation of state effects that you're looking at, I think basically to the ignore it, it just tells you the radius of that given star.
But what you could imagine is that you have, let's say, four different mergers with slightly different masses, and the low mass merger will tell you, or let's say, the low mass merger and its tidal deformability will tell you here the radius at, let's say, 1.2 solar masses. Then you have another merger slightly more massive, and the tidal deformability or the peak tells you here the radius at, let's say, 1.4, okay? Then you have a very massive one, and we are lucky it does not collapse directly because the maximum mass is relatively high. And then you see, oh, from the post-merger, I infer a radius, this error bus that lies somewhere here. And then you see, that looks a bit strange because maybe I actually expected to find something here, but instead the radius was much smaller. And I think this is then really a very strong hint for a phase transition.
Mm.
But again, I mean, we need to understand all details to say something about the inner structure. At the moment, this F mode basically just probes the surface or the size of the remnant and therefore the radius. But I mean, we can always combine tidal deformability, which tells you the radius at smaller masses, and the post-merger remnant, because it contains higher densities, it tells you the radius at somewhat higher masses. But I guess you really need to combine different deformations if you want to say more about the inner structure.
So you have another question. So you have this F20 mode, which is basically, you're claiming it's the medium between this peak mode and the radial oscillation, and it's the fundamental radial oscillation somehow. So if you consider higher order radial oscillations with, let's say, higher frequencies, does that give you even like some F, I don't know, 20 prime, which is forced into a 100 hertz band or something? Is it possible, like, if you have a radial oscillation that with frequency close to the FP, so then you beat and then you get a signal which is of very low frequency?
I have not looked into this, but in principle, yes. But it will be probably also much harder to measure because the amplitude of the coupling will be even smaller. You saw that even this peak was not very much pronounced, right? Which is simply because the radial node is not so strong, and then also the coupling is not so strong, and the higher order modes will be probably even lower, and then the coupling will be even lower. So,
well, we have cosmic support, so we have really good sensitivity at low frequencies. Yeah, maybe
it's possible. For the moment, I'd be happy to see these guys measured. But yeah.
Yeah, and so related also. To this question, the next one is again from these peaks and from the equation of state spectroscopy. Can you isolate these different effects as finite temperature, neutrino transport, magnetic field, and I think we discussed how that magnetic field doesn't change the frequency significantly. But what about these other things like neutrino transport? Does it have?
I think Will, did you? So there's a talk at APS, right? I forgot. But I think the talk was about magnetic field effect on this post-merger stuff. So I remember the conclusion there, if I remember correctly, is that it could shift, let's say, the peak mode frequency by 100 hertz or something like that. I forgot.
I remember that. I think that's definitely a possibility we should keep in mind. If you are, basically having these sort of turbulent effects that are taking all the sort of small scale kinetic energy and putting the magnetic fields, I think that could, not going to radically shift the frequency, but it could shift it at these sort of tens that are percentile or something like that.
Yeah, it's like the magnetic power strength.
Yeah, and definitely I think it will have some effect on how long these modes last.
I mean, this, especially this peak mode, has very high Q, so if you shift by 100 Hz, probably it's still going to measure this shift.
But probably you have a lot of information about that other pieces of physics if you see a counterpart. And then you can, observe what happens, for example, for the rise of the light curve, how fast it decays, whether there are multiple components, God knows what happens in the mass.
Do you think that would tell you the magnetic field, though?
Well, the magnetic field, I have no idea.
Maybe
but
you get some pulse of it or something
yeah.
that you really see, okay, there must be some magnetic activity going on. Maybe you get some additional x-rays or you see really a strong kinetic energy in the ejector.
Yeah.
Maybe that could be an additional hint for strong magnetization.
Yeah, but I guess we're kind of interested in knowing what happens in the first tens, the hundreds, to maybe a second or something. Sort of all the electromagnetic transients we see are happening, 2 seconds or longer after. So yeah, maybe it'll cause something like that. But for these F-mode oscillations, I think they're going to be dominantly sort of the, let's say, first few hundred milliseconds at most.
What is the chance of seeing neutrinos from, I don't know, how deep can we see?
Order of magnitude, you have the same emission as from a core collapse supernova.
Okay.
And core collapse supernova, you can see maybe neighboring galaxies at most.
Okay, so the chances of actually seeing something like this in neutrinos is essentially zero.
Yeah, not zero, but
very small.
I mean, the neutrinos, I think we discussed it during lunch. I mean, in my opinion, the blue component of the ejector is again, this is speculative, but in my opinion, this hints towards strong neutrino irradiation.
So this is one of the reasons why I said, probably if you capture the electromagnetic signature of this merger, then it indirectly may give you some information about, for example, neutrino transfer.
That's probably also going to be sort of one of the primary ways these neutron stars cool, so you might be able to see that in some slight drift in the frequency too, right? It's like hot, so it's slightly puffier, and then begins to cool with cadences.
In the gravitational mesh?
Yeah, I mean, it might be on longer time scales than you can see the gravitational wave.
Yeah, I mean, the cooling time state is a second, right? And I think at that time, the gravitational wave emission is mostly gone. Let's say it's harder to detect.
Yeah, unless you have one of these like long-lived moments, and yeah, maybe the point is like a somewhat enhanced. You could see early stages of.
So if all these things change the spectrum, then how do we diagonalize them?
Yeah, again, by combining information, right? I mean, if you want to make some definite statements, for instance, about finite temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
You can only do this if you understood the cold equation of state. So either from the in-spiral or from NICER or something, and then you can start thinking, then you can start trying to extract finite temperature effects from the post-merger. By the way, I think the temperatures are actually not so high. I mean, you get relatively high temperatures in a shear layer, but the bulge of the matter is not so hot.
So Juan, what's the SNR of our detector for the cold equation of state? Do you remember?
For post-merger signal?
No, the pre-merger.
Pre-merger, it's going to be very big. It's hundreds.
Okay. So we'll probably have it. I mean, have this. We'll be able to do this finite temperature.
What do you mean by hot in this case? Is it like 5,000, 8,000, 10,000?
Compared to Fermi temperature.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like
in kelvins.
Oh, it's 10 to the 10.
Right.
10 to the 10.
Pretty much.
Yeah, but...
That's not so hot compared to the Fermi
generators.
Yeah, it's like way hotter than white dwarfs. It's not like... It's not an invisible.
Dennis, my takeaway message about magnetic fields and neutrino transport from the Maricists, tell me if this is the right thing, but is that we can't diagonalize anything because we don't have any waveforms. So we don't have phase evolution. We have peaks that we have arguments about how much maybe they shift. But this doesn't even include things like magnetic fields and neutrino loss, things like this. So it would be hard to make trustworthy predictions is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I mean, we get more and more simulations with magnetic fields, with more sophisticated neutrinos, so we will get a much better idea how much these peaks possibly shift.
But we're theoretically limited right now, is the point, right?
Yeah,
and I definitely wouldn't trust any of these waveforms, like the phase or something like that.
But for 1708-17, if we have had an instrument that at between 1 kHz and 4 kHz performs as the one you have suggested, the amplitude, and we take a reasonable numerical simulation, okay, the amplitude of the signal would be a factor at any one point, not integrated, would be a factor of 10-ish above the RMS value of the noise. Okay, so you would see, you would really see the signal, by just looking at the data. And of course, it would be then the challenge to try to match it as well as possible.
Yeah, this is what I'm wondering. So imagine you detected some 50 signals with SNR of like 10 or something, and then it doesn't match to any of the models right away. So you probably, what would be the procedure? What would be the physical conclusion that we make? Of course, we can tune all the knobs in the models and reproduce more or less the results. But what does it mean in terms of physics?
That's a pretty early speculation. Such a
great. I'm just curious.
No, that's fine.
Maybe what you would like to have is in particular one loud event where you see as much structure as possible.
Oh.
I mean, there are some studies what you could do with many events, but maybe it would be more.
There is nothing better than a golden event where, it's phenomenal and then you have to match.
Alberto, how confident are you about this statement about SNR 10 in every frequency bin? This sounds
just eyeballing a few quotes. So I haven't done any significant calculation.
My impression is that, Juan probably has that.
And it's not like 10, only 2, something like that. It's priceless.
My
scan.
Yeah. Is that with the 1708-17, it would be, you'd see something, but you wouldn't be like reading off the peak by eye. You'd have to fit it really carefully and...
Okay. Maybe you screwed up the normality.
Yeah, you then can basically compute the post-module SNR, assuming you know the waveform, assuming the detector sensitivity. I think Dennis had the plot.
You're really sure? Okay,
yeah.
I'll cross-check.
Yeah, that is probably in your talk, right? Like,
but is this the match-filtered SNR?
Yeah,
No. I think match filtering here is out.
Exactly.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
Because...
So what distance is this at?
This is 100 megaparsec.
So you see, that's 100 megaparsec. So with a 40 megaparsec, you get a factor of 2.
Yeah, but you have another plot which shows you as.
Pardon?
No, that is
there.
I mean,
at
any frequency,
tons of them.
You see.
Oh, that includes in spiral.
No. This is a poke
question. This one, the previous one we were looking at, that included in spiral power in it. So if we look.
No, this is a post merger.
This is post merger, but
yeah.
The previous slide, I mean.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't even know how you make that kind of plot where you have the time domain. Or, you know, when you do this kind of frequency on frequency thing, you have to make your assumption about your data analysis.
This is just computing SR, choosing like for the post merger waveform, like starting from some, let's say, kilohertz up to.
Not this one, the other one. Yeah.
Oh, this is just
So a lot of this power that's above the noise curve is coming from the in spiral and merger. Is the point?
But only below 1.5 kilohertz.
Exactly. So the one around 2 kilohertz. Okay. There is of course a dependency on the accretion state, etc. But it seems to me that you take a power spectrum. And the power is dominated by the signal and not the noise.
So actually this plot looks inconsistent, or it's difficult to reconcile this one with the other slide we were looking at, because if you just memorize this plot for a second and then go on. Now this is saying that in 1 year, you take the, if I understand right, you take the loudest single event. So this would be like 40 megaparsecs, presumably, and then you get an SNR here in the HF column of 10, depending on the equation of state. That's not an SNR 10.
Yeah, so that's assuming
noise.
That is assuming you pick the, you detect it with the maximum emitting direction, seems like that. So usually, If you do the average of the skies and also the sky in the source frame, you pick a deduction factor of 0.4 or something. So on average, it's 0.4 of the maximum.
But this maximum SNR, this is match filter SNR, right?
Yeah.
So the picture we should have in our mind is that match filter SNR at kilohertz, if you see that match filter SNR at 10, then the amplitude spectral density from the signal is maybe just kissing the noise curve from below.
I agree.
And so when you, if you try to look at it and do a spectrogram analysis, it's going to be, it'll be hard. It won't, when we make an amplitude spectral density of our data, it won't look like the top plot for the first LIGO HF.
So, but I agree with you that the two plots do not agree with each other. There's something wrong.
The plots are, the bottom plot is produced assuming the top part, the waveform from top part, and then this, let's say, the LIGO event rate, this thing. So it looks off because, for example, you see there places the amplitude is big, but then the bandwidth is small. So there is this thing. And also, if you do this average, you have to average over the sky directions of this kind of thing. So this waveform itself is like the maximum emitting direction. So if you perform this simply the sky average, it will pick up a factor of 0.4.
Well, the sky polarization average is 2.26, isn't it?
So you average your the sky over.
Yes. That's the difference between the horizon range and the...
Exactly, and the angle average.
Yeah.
Angle and sky.
Yeah.
Well, factor of 2.5, something like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end, you get this part.
Juan, this sensitive curve is not the one you will use for computer SNR.
Say it's on. It's a secret. It's on the top one.
Oh, yeah, I'm here. Yeah.
Why it's not?
Is it from one?
Is that from
the graduation? I can't tell.
the sensitive curve. The sensitive curve.
I wonder how long
she
has been there, like since the morning.
it's for the previous design with unstable filter, but the one in the bottom, which you show the SNR for the post merger, it's using the the new design which without unstable filter.
Oh, this is for the new.
Yeah, there is a factor of 1.5 difference, 1.7.
Okay, I think we can do the calculation of rigors.
Yeah, all right.
Francisco has some slides tomorrow, but we think, you know, the bottom plot looks about right.
Okay.
But the top one, eyeballing those, they look like us and are a few hundred by eye.
Yeah, although these plots are all using Voyager low frequency, not Voyager high frequency.
So there is a Voyager high frequency?
I just showed it like 30 minutes ago.
Is this derived on the way here?
I just calculated it this morning. That's for the plot I showed you guys. Except I couldn't SSH.
You couldn't SSH into the server. So.
I know, I showed you what I could do this morning, but I still can't log in anymore. I'm being censored.
So related to this, so today we covered the neutron star post-merger oscillations. So I wonder if anyone else has a question, mostly to Will and Andreas about neutron stars. We are kind of running out of time. Yeah.
About this QCD phase transition, etc., are actual dedicated, accelerator nuclear physics, particle physics experiment competitive with what can be done, using accelerators in this scale? I mean, or are we completely, orthogonal?
Yeah, I think the densities are immensely greater than
okay.
what we can do.
So there is no terrestrial experiment that can compete with this.
No, I had a plot. I mean, the densities are more or less comparable to neutron star densities.
Like a heavy ion you're talking about.
Heavy ion, yeah. Temperatures are usually higher. And I mean,
you're referring to the plot that you showed at the very beginning.
Yes.
Or
yes.
First
yes.
slides.
I mean, they can get densities of a few times saturation density. But typically at much higher temperature. And the thing is also, I mean, I don't understand enough about all this, but I had the impression that actually to interpret their data, they make already an assumption about the equation of state. So this is all a bit, and then you have all this entropy around. So I think the merger is a little bit, it's complementary because it's at somewhat lower temperatures. Because if you have these heavy ion collisions, I mean, you always produce entropy, unavoidable.
All right, we're running out of time. Yeah, one more question.
So I think a lot of us are thinking of this, like,
mm-hmm.
so you had your plot, but then There's this baryon density versus temperature plot that shows RIP as being distinct from.
Can you plug it in?
But this was what I had in mind. This is like my intuition as well.
You got HDMI?
Yeah.
Great.
Could you help reconcile kind of like this plot that probably a bunch of people have seen? There we go.
Okay.
And this is like a famous like colloquium plot, but people say, oh, neutron stars are over here and RIP is like over here. But how should we think about this? But you had a plot showing them like closer together.
Yeah, because these are the other accelerators which operate at somewhat lower temperatures. So there are different instruments.
Not RIC, but something else?
Sorry?
Not the RIC experiment?
No. That's at GSI in Darmstadt. They go to lower temperatures, somewhat lower temperatures. It all depends on...
How do they
get
the higher density, though, than RIC?
I don't know exactly. It all depends on which ions you use, how much energy, and so on.
Just to use some whimsical units, I mean, the density of a neutron star is like a teaspoon is a billion tons or something like that, right? So, I mean, maybe, yeah, I mean, how are you exactly defining the densities of these systems? Is it just like in the nuclei, or like how much of this material is actually being gathered at these places?
What do you mean
in
the
area
I'm
conditions? Yeah, like how are you defining the...
I mean, this is something that you get from the data. I mean, they get density profiles. And then you see that this exceeds nuclear density.
You say at the time of collision, if you take the size of the two molecules that you're colliding or something like that, then that is the volume, and that's how you define the density.
Yes, then you get a density profile. I mean,
but the key is, what is the volume you're considering, I think.
Well, I mean, you can take it. I mean, if you have like 200, 400 nucleons and a density of, let's say, 3 times saturation, then you can compute the volume.
No, probably.
A few fermi or so.
I think that's the backwards way. I'm just saying, you have to determine what's the volume. If you say that you're 3 times beyond saturation, that means you've defined some volume.
Yeah.
Did you have the same axes on your plot, or did you had the chemical potential as one of yours? What was the other one?
Sorry?
On your, you had a similar plot to
yes.
that, but one of the axes was chemical potential, and what was the other one?
Temperature also, yeah. But that's more or less the same. If... I mean, all these experiments try to get this curve, try to resolve this curve. But I think in principle the mergers are at somewhat lower temperatures.
Okay, so today we mostly discussed nuclear stuff and neutron star post-merger oscillation. So tomorrow during the discussion session we might actually have here Maxim Prosperov or not tomorrow.
I can send him email.
Because one discussion session should be devoted to the instrument, but that's probably it's either on Wednesday or tomorrow after Zhao and Aidan give that talk. So
you want to bring Maxim for the instrument discussion?
No, I'm just saying we have two discussion slots. So one of them will go for Maxim. And one will go for discussion of the instrument. So, I mean, I'm just saying we have only one discussion slot.
Okay. I'll send an email.
Yeah. So, it's what is more convenient to him, Wednesday or Tuesday? It's fine. Okay. And another thing. So after dinner, a group of us will come back and we'll discuss the unstable filter. So apparently Thomas would like to understand better how it works. I mean, everyone would like to understand. I would like to understand how it works. But I think we at least understand the mass behind it, so we can write some equations, or maybe Thomas can understand better. And then I think Zhao and I and want to talk about controllability. I don't know if Yan Bei, can you make it?
Yep.
And Juan, Rana?
I totally reject your uncontrollability conjecture.
No, I'm saying it's controllable. I'm just saying.
I accept your conjecture, but you have to explain.
No. Yes, I'm saying that the global control has some issues that I want to discuss today. Yeah. Anyhow, so after dinner, probably let's say 6:45. We had dinner in 70 minutes. Had lunch in 70 minutes. I hope we'll have dinner also in 70 minutes. Then 6:45. If you're interested in the unstable filter, please come back. And Shane, are you gonna be online or are you already tired?
Yeah, I guess I will go back to sleep.
You haven't done anything all day.
Have you been here whole day?
I was not at the I was at half Andres' talk, and then I missed the Marshall's talk, but I was at the rest.
Okay. Well, that's fine. We'll discuss the controllability today. If you won't be able to sleep, then please join us.